Okay then, brethren, at this time of year, obviously we're in the midst of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So we're looking at Passover, we're looking at the night to be much remembered, we're looking at ancient Israel's escape and deliverance, heading off on their journey to the Promised Land, to, if you like, the Kingdom of God as they would hopefully experience it. And there's lots of lessons we can learn from their experiences at this time of year, because as they left Egypt, as we leave our spiritual Egypt, they would move into the wilderness where they would meet a number of obstacles. There would be perils, difficulties, hardships, of course also some tests, because God was, I think, curious to see how they would respond in certain situations. Unfortunately, of course, lots of tests, they completely failed, right? And there are lessons there, of course, for you and for me, because we don't want to fail tests that they did. And it turns out that the experiences they had in the wilderness as they headed off to the Promised Land have been written down for our benefit. Let's have a look at that. If we turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and read verses 1 through 13, we'll see that the Apostle Paul looks back at those days. And he specifically and explicitly says the things that happened to ancient Israel as they left Egypt on the way to the Promised Land, those things have been written down, their experiences, their successes, not many of those, their failures, plenty of those, for our benefit. So let's pick up in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, the Red Sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food. All drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. All, maybe 2 million or more, left Egypt. All of them left. All of them baptized. All of them on the way, the journey to the Promised Land. Sounds great, right? But notice verse 5. But, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. And in fact, of the adults, out of all who left, only 2 finally went into the Promised Land. 2 out of, what, 2 million? Wow, right? Verse 6. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should, and then Paul outlines several major problems they had and says we should learn not to walk the way they walked. So he says, verse 6, these things, their experiences in the wilderness, became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they lusted. Do not become idolaters. Us? Well, Paul says we need to watch out. Do not become idolaters as were some of them, as it is written. The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And we're going to read that a bit later. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day, 3,000 fell, died. 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted. Tempt Christ? Did he say there, nor let us believers, nor let us believers tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted Christ and were destroyed by serpents. Nor let us murmur. Never. What? Church members murmur, grumble?
All the time.
Never to be experienced. Nor let us murmur, as some of them also murmured a lot, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, all these things happened to them as examples. They are illustrations. And they were written for our warning, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. So these things were written for your benefit, for my benefit. They were written down to make sure that they'd be there for us to check out. And it says, verse 12, take heed, just be watchful. It doesn't mean we should be, you know, over anxious. Hopefully we are settled in God's ways, but there's no harm in just occasionally checking out this time of year, especially when we tend to be into self-examination and looking out for leaven here and there. It's a good time to be particularly alert. But we shouldn't be overly anxious, because verse 13 says, no temptation or test or trial, the word in Greek can mean all those, no temptation, test or trial has overtaken you except such as common to man. We might think we're unique, but not in terms of tests and trials. Everybody has problems, difficulties, everybody. It's the human experience. But for you and me, God is faithful, which we'll see the ancient Israelites never really got to terms with, God being faithful. It seemed to go over their heads. Nothing God could do could get the point across to them. They just could not see a faithful God at any point. We'll see that in a few moments. But for you and me, God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted, tested, or tried above that you are able, but will, with the temptation, test, or trial, make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. There will be a way of escape. Of course, in ancient Israel's time, as we'll see in a moment, the way of escape, strangely, was through the impassable 8-mile-wide Red Sea. But God made a way of escape, and he's faithful. And so we should understand God is faithful. We can look at ancient Israel, their experiences, and see where they fell down and make sure that we don't fall into the same traps, okay? So what we're going to do is review some of the failures of ancient Israel. And what happened, they had a number of tests, 10, on the wilderness journey up to the borders of the Promised Land. When they got to the borders of the Promised Land, they failed the 10th and final test, all right? And God said, that's it. I've been patient. I've been long-suffering, but this is once too many, once too often. At this point, you're turning around, you're heading into the wilderness, you will die there. And God said, you've provoked me 10 times. So what we'll do now is look at these 10 occasions, these 10 events, these 10 tests where God tested the people and the people provoked God. And again, these things are written for you to learn from, and of course for me. So let's start in Exodus 14. Exodus 14, starting with verses, 5 through 12. This is immediately after the Passover, immediately after the night, to be much remembered. They're heading off with a high hand, heading for the Promised Land. Verse 5. Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this? Why have we let the people go? Well, because Pharaoh, your nation is in ruins, that's why. So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. And he took also 600 choice chariots, plus all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them, as well as footmen. Josephus says it was 200,000 footmen, 50,000 chariots. So, you know, quite a decent sized army of what was left of, I guess, what was once a bigger army. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out, or had gone out, with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-hahiroth before Baal-zephon, which is by the sea. And the sea is quite deep there, and it's about 8 miles across the Red Sea. When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, oh my word, the Egyptians are marching after them. So they were very afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt where we were fine and comfortable and it was okay? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone, leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians as their slaves? for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. Now, pretty negative, aren't they? There is no confidence here in deliverance. They can't see God in the situation. They are clearly walking by sight and not by faith. And you might say, well, you know, fair enough, the 250,000 soldiers coming after them, and there's mountains to the north, mountains to the south, the army's coming in from the west, and there's 8 miles of deep sea to your right, there's nowhere to go, we're doomed. In a sense, you can understand that, but don't forget, these people had seen 10 plagues from God over the land to destroy the land of Egypt. They'd been preserved themselves. They had already witnessed quite a bit of God's miracle-working power in their favor. How come so quickly they're panicking, fearful, don't see God in this? It didn't take very long, did it? Just a couple of 3 days has passed, and already they don't see God. He doesn't exist. And of course, some of the lessons here obviously are, you know, we should be careful to make sure that we do see God in situations. We can see here that when you walk out God's way, particularly early in our journey, the world can pursue us. Sometimes our families, our former buddies can pursue us. The world comes after us, try and take us out before we've got much practice in living God's way. That can happen. Let's move on, verses 13 through 16. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see no more again forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." And the Lord said to Moses, "Why cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. But lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea." Well, really? That sounds incredible. And of course, a lot of people don't believe it took place. But here's the sea, the Red Sea. It is 8 miles across at that point. It's quite deep. And Moses stretched his hand out. The waters divided, and the people went through on dry land. Verses 21 to 31. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. You may have seen the Charlton Heston film.
If you go to
Universal Studios, I think it is, in Hollywood,
yeah.
You can see the sea divides as you go through in a little sort of train, little carriage,
yeah.
Little buggy, to experience just what it was like. Nothing like it was like. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. This is dramatic. This is miraculous. This is incredible. And if you were an Israelite, and now you can see a way of escape across an impassable sea, and you're walking on dry land with a sea up like a high wall to your right and to your left, and you're walking through, this is the final proof that God's on your side. You will never doubt God again after this moment, because this is the final proof you needed of God's protection and deliverance and miracle-working power and favour towards you. And the Egyptians, verse 23, pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. He took off their chariot wheels, so that they drove them with difficulty. Imagine with no wheel. It's tricky to drive a chariot very fast. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen." And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, it's fairly deep there, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. They saw dead Egyptian bodies on the shore, floating in the water, no doubt, horses floating in the water. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt, so the people feared the Lord, believed the Lord, and his servant Moses. Like I said, that's it done now. That's them fine. The proof, the evidence that God can open up seas, can take us on dry land, can destroy 250,000 or more in the army and the chariots and the horsemen of Egypt. God's on our side. We can never fail. We believe. We see the evidence, and seeing is believing, as we all know. Only it didn't work that way. So that, in a sense, was the first of the 10 tests. They doubted the wisdom of leaving Egypt. They were scared and fearful. They complained to Moses, "We'd rather you left us there as slaves and taking us out here to die. We're doomed." And of course, God, "Hold on, guys, I can take care of this." So God helps them. So the first test, in a sense, they wobbled quite badly, didn't they? But let's move on to the second test. So we're looking at Exodus 15, next chapter, verses 22 to 26. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, where they'd seen tens of thousands of dead bodies floating around. Then they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 whole days in the wilderness and found no water. Now when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was called, Marah, meaning bitter. And the people murmured, grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Right? So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. And when he cast it into the waters were made sweet. So here they are. They've seen they've seen 10 miracles and plagues in Egypt, right? They've seen the Egyptian nation destroyed essentially. They just walked through several miles on dry land through the sea. They've seen the Egyptian armies floating dead. They witnessed that, saw that. 3 days later, they're grumbling, murmuring, complaining. They've got strife. They've got anxiety. Why? Because God's on their side. They know that. But actually, they don't. Just 3 days later, they're complaining. They're whinging, they're murmuring, they're doubting. "We're doomed. No water, we can't drink that water. It's bitter and poisonous." But of course, God steps in. And so we see here that God showed Moses how to make the water sweet. Great. Verse 25, the end of, "There God made a statute and an ordinance for them. And there he tested them." Because it was a bit of a test, just how will these people react to the lack of water for 3 days? And when they do finally get to water, "Oh, no relief, look, water, can't get there quick enough, and oh, you can't drink this stuff." What are they going to do? Just say, "It's not a problem. Our God is faithful. He'll see us through. And Moses, how do you think God will work here to our benefit?" But they don't, do they? And do we? Are we quick to grumble and complain and so on? And God tests them there, and I think they didn't do very well in this test. And God said, "If you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, if you live an unleavened life, in other words, I'll put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you." Quite a decent promise. In the Hebrews, "I am Jehovah Rapha. I am your God healer," as some translations place it. So God performs a miracle on the water. The people can drink until they're content. And God says, "By the way, whilst we're here, I am Jehovah, your healer." Sounds pretty good. And you think, well, they stumbled slightly there. Didn't really see that God would be faithful. But obviously now they've learned that lesson, right? Never again will they ever doubt God. Until, of course, the next chapter. So let's look at the third sort of test. And you can see here, of course, they're still walking by sight, aren't they? If they can't see it, they have no belief. Chapter 16, verses 1 to 3, the third test. And they journeyed from Elim, that's where we just left them, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, unusual name, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. So about, you know, a month has elapsed now, 15th to the 15th, 4 weeks later. And then the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Really? Grumbling, murmuring, complaining, doubtful, angry. And the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt." Not impressive, is it? "When we sat by the pots of meat, the burgers, the super duper chicken, all that wonderful flavors and so on, when we had bread to the full, when our bellies were full and we were happy. But you, pair, have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Oh, this isn't very good at all. Again, if this was the first test they'd ever had anywhere, but they've seen some incredible miracles, right? But what they've got here is a little bit of hardship. You know, they've gone a bit further in the journey, and there's not much in the way of food around you in the wilderness, after all. And there's some physical discomforts, some physical challenges, a little bit of hardship. Complain. Oh, if only we'd been left behind that former way of life, pots of meat, you know, the goodies that we'd like, the cheeseburgers, you know, the big jugs of Coca-Cola, you know, 7-Up, all that stuff we used to enjoy, and now we're out here in the desert and there's nothing. So they're whinging, they're complaining. And of course, ultimately they're complaining against God, because don't they believe this is God's purpose, God's plan? Don't they believe that pillar of fire up there, that pillar of cloud, has got something to do with where they're going and how they're getting there? Do they see God? Of course not. All they're thinking about is what they can see. And their belly is grumbling, and oh, I can't carry on. It's a terrible journey. This. Oh, I'm so hungry. But of course, God kindly steps in. Verses 4 and 5. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you.'" This would be, of course, the manna. "And the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. And it shall be in the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in. It shall be twice as much as they gather daily." God's going to provide them with bread from heaven, nourishment, every day for 6 days. But it's going to be a test as well, to see if, will these people cooperate with me? Well, will they listen to me? Will they trust me? Can I sort of work with these people and eventually give them the promised land? Or are they going to continually fail? So God wants to know, and so the provision of the manna will become essentially a test. Let's look at the fourth test, fourth provocation of God, which we find in chapter 16, verses 16 through 20. Verses 16 through 20. "And this is a thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it," this is the manna, "according to each one's need, one omer for each person, according to the number of persons, let every man take for those who are in his tent." So go out and gather in what you need. "And the children of Israel did so, and gathered, some more, some less. So when they measured it by omers, he who had gathered much had nothing over. He who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need," you know, the size of your family and so on. "And Moses said, 'Let no one leave any of it until the morning.'" You've got to consume it today, right? You go out every day, God will supply it. You go out every day and collect it. Don't hoard it. Don't keep it for the following day. Don't do that. "Notwithstanding," verse 20, "they did not heed Moses," or God, "but some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them." And if Moses was angry, you can bet your boots God was angry, right? Because we're made in God's image. Very often things that disturb us and offend us, God has the same feelings. Because God has said, use it the same day. I'll bring you some more tomorrow. So why did these people leave it till the next day? Well, disobedience, rebellion, but probably they don't trust God. It's there today. I'm getting as much as I can today, and I'm going to put a little bit for tomorrow because, well, thing is, you just never know what God's going to do. We got some today, but can't count on that tomorrow, can you? I mean, how faithful is this Jehovah being? I mean, we don't know much about him. And so clearly they doubt God. They doubt God's provision. You know, I can say, give us this day our daily bread. Now, most of us have got huge stocks of food in our freezers and fridges and outhouses, and especially at the moment when stocking up, you know, as good preppers. But I mean, essentially, the lesson is, well, do we believe that God would provide for us day by day, day by day? Or do we think, oh, better stock up plenty now, it's down to me. It's all down to me. Well, you know, seeing is believing. If I can see the food's there in the corner, then I can see the food. And so God's not happy because essentially it's an implied, it shows that they don't trust God any further than they can see him, because there's nowhere, right? We move on to the fifth of the times that they tested God and disappointed God in their behavior. Same chapter, but reading verses 23 to 30. And the same topic, really, but the other side of it. Verse 23. So Moses said to the people, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow, so this would be a Friday conversation, tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today of the manna, boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. Right? So this conversation here about the Sabbath, the holy Sabbath of the Lord. And this is Exodus 16. The Ten Commandments don't arrive until Exodus 20, you know, Mount Sinai, the two tablets, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. But here we see that the Sabbath is already in existence. And at least at this time, if not before, God says, my holy Sabbath, I'm going to put you to the test. Will you be obedient to my holy Sabbath? And so he says here, you can keep your extra surplus manna until the Sabbath, because it'll be okay then, which is not normally the case. So they laid it up till morning, verse 24, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink. No, there any worms in it. A miracle. You get to the Sabbath day and the manna is preserved, still fresh, still usable. Both pretty good. So you don't have to go out and collect it. So you can therefore, you know, cease from your work and rest on the holy Sabbath day. Pretty good, right? And for 40 years, God built that habit of 6 days, but the seventh is holy. 6 days, but the seventh is holy. Then Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. Plain, clear, simple. You've got the day off. Verse 27. Now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but of course found none because God's not supplying it. And the Lord said to Moses, ah, come on, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you in the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let nobody go out of his place on the seventh day. And so the people rested on the seventh day. But, you know, God's angry. And so is Moses. God says, how long do you refuse? How often are you going to rebel? What's the problem with you guys? I've told you. But of course, you know, these people were, again, just not trusting of God. So they're going to go out and, you know, lean into their own understanding, right under God's nose. They can't trust God. They can't see that God would help. They're going to go out on the seventh day and find more that we need to look after ourselves. Right? It's a very bad example. And of course, that's one that you and I can certainly think about ourselves, because you and I keep the Sabbath, which is a phrase I'm a little bit cautious with. We keep the Sabbath and they keep Sundays. We might sometimes say, well, we are Sabbath keepers, unlike them who are nothing, agnostics or Sunday keepers or whatever. But actually, it's not just keep the Sabbath. We keep the Sabbath. The phrase is keep the Sabbath holy, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. The Sabbath day from sunset to sunset is not ours. We've got 6 days to do our stuff, whatever it might be, but the seventh day is protected. The time is protected. It doesn't mean we're locked down to doing absolutely nothing. You know, when I first heard about the Sabbath when I was, I think it was 15 at the time, and, do no work in the Sabbath. So I remember once I was left to my own on a Saturday up in Scotland, the very early weeks of finding out about the Sabbath day, and I thought, I can't do anything. It's the Sabbath. Can't do anything. So I didn't even want to put the kettle on for a cup of tea and didn't want to eat anything that was warmed up because it's work. So that particular first Sabbath, I had, I think, two cold apples because no work required apart from chomping on them. And of course, I realized fairly quickly that was probably not how to have an ideal Sabbath day, to basically be very hungry and just drink water and have two apples, right? But of course, there's another extreme, which is to do everything you want on the Sabbath day. It's just time off, but I can't be bothered. You know, I'm going to watch an hour's video a bit later on the Sabbath. I'm going to join in services with this person or that group or these people. And once I've done that 1 hour, that's the Sabbath done. You know, it's up to you in a sense. You know, God gives us quite a bit of rope here, but obviously the Sabbath is time that is to be used in a sort of slightly more useful way than just say a Friday or a Monday, right? So just a word to the wise there. Make sure that we're keeping the Sabbath day holy for a proper purpose, and if like separated or dedicated. Okay, that was the fifth of the 10 times that Israel provoked God, and where when he tested them, he discovered that, not looking too good. On to the sixth one, which is Exodus chapter 17, and let's read verses 1 through 7. So Exodus chapter 17 and verses 1 through 7. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. They're still heading off towards Mount Sinai, not quite there yet. And there's no water. Well, so what? Now, by now, surely you think, well, the Israelites have seen God's plagues in Egypt, have been brought through the Red Sea. The waters were made sweet. Every day they're finding that there's manna just out there to be collected to feed them. It's quite obvious that God is a faithful provider, that God is on our side, that God is taking us to this promised land that he promised to our forefathers, to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, right? So there's no water here, but that's no problem because our God does his stuff. We can trust our God. Only, of course, they can't. So here's another provocation of God, and quite a provoking provocation. Therefore, the people contended with Moses. I think one translation says chided with Moses, or quarrelled, some translations say, or getting bad-tempered. Therefore, the people contended or quarrelled with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, but why are you quarrelling with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? Why are you testing the Lord? God's testing them, if you like, to see how they respond to a little bit of hardship. And they're testing God, saying, well, we'll see what they say. And the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? We've read this already. I mean, do these guys not ever learn? Do we ever learn? Because these things are written for our admonition. And how long does it take to come to a belief in God and a trust in God? So Moses cried out to the Lord, verse 4, and said, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. That's how bad it got. You know, tempers were hot. And some of these people were obviously, you know, quite aggressive people. And, you know, Moses was generally well able for them, but they're getting ready here to sort of riot. Where is their trust in God? I mean, it appears to be zero, doesn't it? Even after all these miracles. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock, in Horeb, which is Mount Sinai, or that range at least, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. Now, there's a miracle for you. You strike a big rock and it splits, presumably outpours torrents of fresh, delicious, living water. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" I mean, really, that's sort of it's appalling behavior. Is God among us or not? Does he care for us or not? Right? You know, the term Massah means temptation. That's one of the names given to the place. Another is Meribah, which means contention or provocation. That was a bad time, and the people failed that test. I mean, big time. You know, they're always looking at the physical, aren't they? They're always walking by sight, you know, never by faith. And some of the lessons we can learn here, amongst others, are, you know, the way of God is not necessarily always cushy, easy, luxurious. I've chosen to go God's way because it's just such a wonderfully abundant and prosperous lifestyle. Nothing bad can ever happen as I walk God's way. There will never be a test in my life, never a tribulation, never a persecution, because I'm going God's way, and God will bless my way and smooth my path in every way. Well, of course, there are these occasional tests, and they're written down for our learning. But I mean, that last sentence there, is the Lord among us or not? How dismissive, you know, how rebellious, I mean, how stupid. They've just seen about who knows how many miracles, right? So they failed that test, you know, big time. And you can see how quick they were to grumble and to blame. Moses, it's your fault. Aaron, it's your fault. God, it's your fault. Got to be careful not to blame people and grumble too quickly. Seventh test we'll find in Exodus 32. Exodus 32. And we're moving on to verses 1 through 6 to start with. Now this is Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments, Mount Sinai. This is a few weeks beyond that, but they're still at Mount Sinai. They're still at the mountain where the Ten Commandments were given. And we pick up the story in Exodus 32, 1 through 6. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, Mount Sinai, the people gathered together to Aaron, or one translation says gather against Aaron, almost like they're hostile to Aaron, and said to him, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. He's been gone for 40 days, I think, at this stage. And well, I don't know where he's got to. He might be dead up the mountain for all we know. And make some other gods to take us forward into the promised land. They can go before us." Aaron said to them, "Don't be silly. Let's worship God Almighty." Aaron said, "Okay. Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters." So I guess the young boys had golden earrings as well. "And bring them to me." So all the people broke off the golden earrings that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf, little baby bull, in gold. Then they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. Aaron saw it? Aaron engraved it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to Jehovah." Now, interesting in a sense, they weren't necessarily committing idolatry with a different god. He said, "Tomorrow's a feast to Jehovah, and we'll use this little bull to help us worship Jehovah." Then they rose up early in the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And the commentaries will tell you that rose up to play means probably an orgy, right? For example, the Good News Bible says of verse 6, "The people sat down to a feast which turned into an orgy of drinking and sex." These are the people of God. Right, and they're in a bad way. I mean, is this a bad way or not? You're actually at Mount Sinai still. God's up there with Moses, and you're having an orgy. with a golden bull in front of you. I mean, really, it's talk about testing God. Verses 7 to 14. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go, get down, for your people..." Obviously, this is a bit unfair here, but Moses was up for it. "Your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, Moses, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of their way." Quickly? I mean, the ink's barely dry on the Ten Commandments, and already they're worshipping a bull. "They've turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people.'" And God was entitled to say, "You know what, Moses? I've got the promised land waiting there. I want to take my people into it and to enjoy it, the land flowing with milk and honey. But this is the number of times now I've put these people to just a modest test. Not even a test here, really, just a bit of a delay. And you know what, Moses? It's not going to happen. These people can't do it. They'll never cooperate with me. They have zero trust in me. They have zero trust in my faithfulness. I cannot use these people, Moses." That'd be a fair comment on God's part. That's what he sort of said here. He says, verse 10, "Now therefore let me alone, Moses, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I'll consume them, and I'll make of you a great nation." Right? And that's actually a fair comment, because how could God possibly work with this bunch if they finally ever went over the border into the promised land? I mean, they're hopeless, aren't they? But these things are written for, of course, our admonition. We'd never be like that, would we? Nah, don't think so. "Then Moses pleaded with the Lord his God and said, 'Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak and say, he brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains, to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn, please, from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. Remember, look, think back of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven. All this land that I have spoken of, I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it, the promised land.'" Come on, you know, God, remember. "So the Lord relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people." Just as well that Moses did intercede there. Drop down to verses 19 to 28. "So it was, as soon as he came near the camp, that Moses saw the calf and the dancing, wild dancing. So Moses' anger became hot, and he cast the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. Then he took the calf which they had made, burned it in the fire, ground it to powder. He scattered it on the water and made the children of Israel drink it." Not quite sure how that works, but that's what it says. "And Moses said to Aaron, 'What did this people do to you that you have brought so great a sin upon them?'" What threat was there? Did they hold a gun to your head or something? Or hold your feet over hot coals? What did they do? Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, that they are set on evil." Which is fairly true, of course. "For they said to me, 'Make us gods that shall go before us.' As for this Moses, this chappie, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we have no idea what's become of him. Missing for ages. And I said to them, 'Well, whoever has any gold, let them break it off.' So they gave it to me. I cast it into the fire." Would you believe it? Would you Adam and Eve it? A calf came out. Astonishing. Aaron obviously caved in big time. This was a man of God who obviously was essentially, in a sense, chicken. When the pressure's on, like the,
Chocolate Christians,
they melt when the heat's on. That was a chocolate Christian. You melt when the heat's on. Well, he melted pretty quickly. Now, when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained,
naked.
I think the King James says naked, and the NET translation says running wild, probably running wild and naked. "For Aaron had not restrained them to their shame among their enemies. Then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said, 'Whoever is on the Lord's side, let him come to me.' And quite a number did, but particularly taken out here are all the sons of Levi gathered together with them. Of course, Moses was also a Levite, so it's his tribe in that sense, but I imagine quite a lot came to that side, especially the tribe of Levi. And he said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let every man put his sword on his side and go in and out from entrance to entrance throughout the camp, and let every man kill his brother, every man his companion, every man his neighbour." That would be of those that hadn't come across to Moses' side. So the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Right? So that's sort of quite unfortunate. You're at Mount Sinai, God's up the top of the mountain, and you end up with an orgy, a bull, and 3,000 believers, you know, dead. And what was the problem there? Well, the main problem appears to be impatience. Oh, where's Moses gone to? We haven't seen Moses around for a while. Moses is our leader. Where's he got to? Hey, Aaron, we're fed up waiting for this character. We don't know where he's got to. He could be dead up the mountain, you know, the vultures picking his flesh off his bones. You make us gods that can take us into Egypt. We're fed up waiting. Or take us into promised land. We're fed up waiting. Well, you know, God can delay, probably for very good reasons. And this reason, he's busy talking to Moses, of course, and giving him tons of instructions. And the people get impatient. And again, we can see the danger there. Do we ever get impatient waiting for God and think, oh, I think I can do it myself? I'm reminded often of Abraham and Sarai. God said to Abraham, you'll have a son and I'll multiply him as the stars of the sky and the sand on the seashore, you know, multiple descendants and nations. And it didn't happen immediately. Time passed, a few years passed. There was a delay, sort of a test, you could say, of Abraham. And he failed it. If you remember, Abraham and Sarai talked together and Sarai says, tell you what, why don't you take Hagar, you know, my servant, and you know, be with her, and you may have a child. And of course, Ishmael came along, but that's not good enough. You know, God said, I'll give you a son, the son of promise, who is Isaac. And of course, between Isaac and his descendants and Ishmael, his descendants, there was lots of friction and strife brought about by Abraham and Sarah not waiting for the Lord to come through, but doing things themselves. And of course, here the same story. You know, you and I have to be patient at times, perhaps longer than we would want, but impatience and then starting to do things ourselves, not a great idea, really. And you can see here, of course, how quick these people were to, you know, at least a form of idolatry. Let's move on to the 8th of our 10 tests. That's in Numbers now. We'll leave Exodus, move on in Numbers. Still the same general period of time, but Numbers chapter 10, verse 33. Numbers 10 and 33. And then chapter 11, verses 1 through 3. There's a bit in the parentheses in the middle, but the story is verse 33 and then to 11:1. So 10:33. So they departed from the mountain of the Lord, that's Sinai, Horeb, on a journey of 3 days. I don't know how long they've been there, obviously 40 days while Moses up the mountain, maybe a little bit longer. So maybe 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 weeks, whatever. Some time to get perhaps a bit comfortable, a bit sort of settled. But now they journey from the mountain of the Lord 3 days. And the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them for the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them. I guess not everywhere suitable for a couple of million people to settle down. Chapter 11, verses 1 through 3. Now when the people complained, so a 3 day journey, and here they are in their default mode of complaining. It displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it, and his anger was arisen. God doesn't easily get angry. You know, he's slow to anger, as we're supposed to be. So there's obviously something happening here, which unfortunately the details aren't given to us. But they're complaining and grumbling, and whatever the situation exactly was, God is not at all pleased. So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and when Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire was quenched. So he called the name of the place Taberah, because the fire of the Lord had burned among them and burned up some of the people because they complained. Now, a couple of translations bring out what might be behind it. In talking in verse 1, the Amplified translation says, "And the people grumbled and deplored their hardships, which was evil in the sight of the Lord." Or the Message translation says, "The people fell to grumbling over their hard life, and God wasn't too pleased." Now, nothing specific is mentioned. Was it just it was too long, the journey? It was taking too long. They were getting sort of fed up quickly. Was it too inconvenient at that time to sort of move out? Was the journey suddenly, to their minds, too arduous? Right? And they grumbled and complained and whinged, which is standard almost for them. And God starting to get himself a little bit sort of like agitated here by these people. He can't seem to do anything right for them. So always arguing, they're always contending, they're always complaining. And I'm supposed to trust these people to enter the promised land and take it over when I can't even get them to walk a 3-day journey without complaining? Now, of course, from our perspective, you know, our journey can sometimes be quite arduous. So there can be obstacles and hardships we didn't quite expect, right? But as we know from the New Testament scriptures, we don't need to compare the sufferings of this present time with the glory that will one day be revealed in us. You know, Paul talked about the sort of light afflictions, which are but for a moment, compared to the eternal weight of glory that lies ahead of us. There are light afflictions. There are sufferings in this present journey that we've got. Not everything will work out well. We're somewhat prone to the environment we're in. But to start grumbling and complaining, and I mean, in a sense, there's probably two types of grumbling here. I mean, you and I might go out to a restaurant, well, in olden days when we could actually leave the house, go to a restaurant and it's disappointing. You know, the food takes ages to arrive. When it comes, part of it's burnt, the other part of it's cold, and we grumble and complain and whinge. And quite right, you could argue, and probably quite right. If you're going to pay good money for a meal, you don't want it to be late and cold and all the rest of it. You order something on the internet, says it'll be there in 2 days. You wait a week and the wrong thing arrives. You grumble and complain. Well, fair enough. But I think the grumbling that God's really focusing on here is grumbling about the experiences of walking his way of life. Right? God says, "This is the broad way that leads to destruction, and many there be that go down there. But the way that leads to eternal life is narrow, and if only a few people go down that road." And I think if you and I are complaining about going God's way, grumbling about God's way, I've got to give up those things and give up my chasing loose women and give up my trips to Las Vegas to the casinos, and I've got to give up this and give up that, and it's not fair. That's where you and I might get into trouble. So comparing God's way or looking at God's way and complaining, that's not fair. I should be able to do things that others in the world have done. So be careful about grumbling of the experiences and the byproducts of going the way of God. And of course, in terms of grumbling and so on, you've got to think that actually you and I are supposed to continue enduring unto the end. "He that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved." So we have to watch our whinging, don't we? And clearly these people just lack the vision. I mean, if they'd thought about a little bit longer, "We're going to cross over the borders. We're going to see a beautiful land with orchards and vineyards and pastures and grain fields and pomegranates and grapes. Oh, not long now, guys. Let's just power on through. Let's just trust our God." But of course they didn't. The ninth one we find just immediately afterwards, starting in verses 4 through 6. Numbers 11, 4 through 6. "Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, 'Who will give us meat to eat?'" So, I mean, some desires are fine, but desires become too intense. And it says here, intense craving with the rabble who had left Egypt with them, which obviously affected Israel. It didn't take too much to affect the Israelites. And the rabble soon had them whinging about meat, meat, meat. Verse 5, "We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic, all those wonderful things back in our slave days. But now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing except this crummy manna. What, I mean, the provision that God's giving you every day? Yeah, be a bit careful, right? Now the manna, well, we'll just finish there and move on to verses 10 to 15. Then Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was greatly aroused. Moses also was displeased, because there's no gratitude here. They're not even asking politely, Moses, could you ask God if we could have a little bit of a change? They're just whinging, grumbling, complaining, and looking back with selective memories upon our wonderful life as slave people with the fish and the cucumbers and the garlic and the whips over our back and all the rest of it. So Moses said to the Lord, why have you afflicted your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I beget them? That you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a guardian carries a nursing child to the land which you swore to their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they weep all over me saying, meat, 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 must have meat, meat, meat. Right? I'm not able to bear all these people alone because the burden is too heavy for me. If you treat me like this, please kill me here and now. I've had enough. I want out. I didn't bargain for this. Right? So poor old Moses in a bit of a tiz-was here. But moving on to verses 18 to 23, God says, you shall say to the people, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. God heard all of that. God hears our grumblings. Therefore, the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. Now, that's a bit of a caveat. You shall eat not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but for a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you because you've despised the Lord who is among you and have wept before him saying, why did we ever come up out of Egypt? You know, like sometimes we've had maybe a big turkey or a big chicken and too much for one day, so you have a day two, and so turkey sandwiches day three, and bit of turkey and gravy day four. And you know what? I've had enough turkey for about another 10 years. But God says here, 30 days, that's all you're going to eat. And Moses said to God, well, hang on, verse 21. The people whom I am among are 600,000 men on foot. Yet you have said, I will give them meat that they may eat for a whole month. Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them to provide enough for them? Shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to provide enough for them? You know, Moses is getting slightly uptight here. How can you feed all these people with meat? Come on, it's ridiculous. God. And the Lord said to Moses, oh, really? Has the Lord's arm been shortened? Right? Now you shall see whether my word will befall you or not. Drop down to verses 31 to 34. Now a wind went out from the Lord and it brought quail from the sea and left them fluttering near the camp, about a day's journey on this side, about a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, and about 2 cubits above the surface of the ground. And the people stayed up all that day, all that night, all the next day, and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers, and they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. So they stayed up 2 whole days and a night just grabbing these quail and pulling them down and bashing them, whatever you do with quail when you catch them. It says the one who gathered least had 10 homers. Well, a homer apparently is a donkey load. So the one who had least had 10 donkey loads of quail. The one who had most had who knows how many donkey loads of 50 donkey loads of quail. Why? I mean, why would you do that? Yeah, having a few quail, understandable with no meat for months beforehand, right? But why would you want 10 donkey loads, 20 donkey loads? Well, because you've no trust. It's here. I'm getting it right here and now. You never know how this Jehovah being is going to act. This might be the last meat we ever see. You can't trust him. You know, they should have known by now that God's on their side, right? So they gathered up all this meat, tons of it apiece, right? But while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed or digested, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people, and the Lord struck the people with very great plague. So Moses called the name of the place Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people who yielded to craving. Well, I'm going to guess the reality was that they just stuffed their faces with all this quail. Greedy, right? Gluttonous. And one would imagine probably nowhere to be found any thanks to God. You know, thank you, God in heaven, for providing us with this change in our diet. We appreciate it very much, and we're grateful for it. Amen. One imagines it was, look at all this stuff, tear. And of course, God said, well, a bunch of losers, you know, going to destroy a whole bunch of them. They're just greedy, gluttonous, useless, unbelieving, disobedient, rebellious people. Which unfortunately, you know, they were. Other than that, they were perfectly okay. And of course, they'd initially yielded to the rabble in their midst. Just a reminder that you and I need to be careful of our company. Bad company corrupts good manners, as Paul said much later on. So you can be misled by your company. Tenth and final test we find in Numbers 14, so we're almost there. We'll read verses 1 to 10. The story here was, of course, it sent out the 12 spies to look over the promised land. They were right at the border at this point. 10 came back, or 2 came back and said, great, you know, Joshua and Caleb, let's go. It's ours, we can take it. A wonderful place. 10 spies brought back an evil report. And of course, you know, the cities are fortified, and they're all giants in the land. We're like grasshoppers. We get no chance. And of course, the people believed the bad report. Chapter 14, verse 1. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured, surprise, surprise, against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, if only we had died in this wilderness. The story hasn't changed, has it? All these opportunities that God's given them, all the times he's given them another miracle, another miracle, another miracle, another miracle. I've looked after you here and here and here and here, and nothing changes. They are really beyond redemption. And of course, you've got to be careful what you say. If only God had killed us in the wilderness. Shouldn't have said that. Why has the Lord brought us out to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us select a leader. Not Moses, of course, another leader. And we'll go back to Egypt. What? Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation. Verse 6, Joshua and Caleb, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes in frustration. And they spoke to all the congregation and said, the land we passed through to spy out is exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Only don't rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them. You know, they're going to be easy for us. The Lord is with us. Don't fear them. And all the congregation said, oh, amen, brother. We hear you. Let's go. All the congregation said, stone them with stones. I mean, this is one where God just realizes, I think, that no, it's not going to work. I've tried, I've tested, I perform miracles, I can do no more. This was the final line, they've passed over the line, I'm finished with this lot. So he threatens to destroy them all, not for the first time. Moses intercedes, says, oh, please don't do that. Again, not for the first time. And God heeds, you know, Moses, but God's got a final punishment. He's finished with these people. There's no more. No more attempts. Verse 20 through 35. Then the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word, Moses, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and notice, have put me to the test now these 10 times, 10 provocations of God, and have not heeded my voice at any time, they certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. Caleb, right, he will see it. Drop down to verse 26. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who murmur against me? I have heard the murmurings which the children of Israel murmur against me." And they always murmured, complained, grumbled. He could never satisfy them. "Say to them, 'As I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do it to you.'" You said it. You're going to get it. "The carcasses of you who have murmured against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who were numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and above." The kids will be okay, but not the adults. "Except for Caleb and Joshua, you shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in." It was God's will at all times to give these people the promised land, but they couldn't work with God. "But your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I will bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. As for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years and bear the brunt of your infidelity, your unfaithfulness, until your carcasses are consumed in this wilderness. According to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection." They've rejected God again and again and again. God says, "Okay, now you'll know what it's like for me to reject you. I, the Lord, have spoken this. I will surely do so to all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be consumed, and there they shall die." You know, God is very patient. You can see that. Somebody once said, God took the people out of Egypt, but he couldn't get Egypt out of the people. They just grumbled and complained. And for you and I, sometimes our journey can seem very long. Sometimes there are hardships, unexpected difficulties. But will we be faithful to God? Because he'll be faithful to us, right? Do we see God? Or do we always tend to walk by sight and not by faith? Our final scripture is in Romans 15. We turn there. Romans 15. And we'll read verse 4, I think, just to save a bit of time. Romans 15 and verse 4. Romans 15 and verse 4. It reminds us where we started. "For whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the scriptures, might have hope." What's written there in Exodus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and those places, those are lessons written for us. Like Paul says, whatever things were written before were written for our learning. And we can learn a lot there. So this time of year, Passover, unleavened bread, we've done a wee bit of a self-examination, perhaps, as we approach Passover. We're alert today and for the next few days for spiritual leaven in our lives. Make sure we put it out, like physical leaven. And it's worthwhile this time of year just having a little think about ancient Israel, their exodus, their wilderness journey, the experiences they had, and the lessons that are written down for you and me to learn from. Because we do not want to try and walk the way they did. Because that failed utterly. And we have a better way of walking. Okay, with that we'll conclude today's Bible study.